Accession number 17747, reel 53.
I had asked you what ILOT stood for.
Yes, ILOT was the name of Jim ILOT, a friend of mine, who on the 28th of May, it was quite suddenly, out of the blue, posted from 64th Field Regiment to the 8th Indian Division alongside several other ranks and two other officers. His release number was quite a low one, 27, which would mean a relatively early release. And if he was being posted elsewhere, what was likely to happen to me? I began to count the days to my own posting to some unknown place. At this time, we were still stuck in the hills with snakes being killed and continual boring bridge going on in the mess tent.
This is in the area of Gorizia?
This is in the area of Gorizia, yes.
Had your supplies been restored, or, you know, because you were saying that Tito blocked the supply lines?
Oh, I don't think that lasted long. I mean, it was an attempt. It was posturing, really. I think there was no serious hold-up of supplies.
Presumably you'd already started to lose men going back for release.
Yes, all kinds of things were happening. People were... The earliest releases were taking place, demobilisation. People were being posted to fill gaps in other units.
Did you get people posted in to fill the gaps in yours to replace the men who'd gone back for
I think
release?
I think there were one or two strange faces. I remember one particularly unpleasant lieutenant who was had no sense of humour at all, but who was a regular, obviously posted out to get his knees brown for a while before going to the staff or something like that. But there wasn't a lot of intaking. It was mostly people going out.
Presumably this must have resulted in a reduction in the efficiency of the
yes,
unit.
I think that's right. And had we been called back into serious action, I think this might have been revealed. But in fact, we were not. It was really a matter of... Oh, most awful uncertainty. And I suppose the CO, whom I didn't much care for, but to do him credit, he must have had a very worrying time wondering what the hell to make of life. You know, half in action.
Half out.
People changing, half out of action, under orders to prepare people for civilian life, release, and so on. In the middle of all this lot, I was busy preparing education courses for all the men in the battery. But in the middle of that, on the 31st of May, I found I'd been put in for a current affairs course in Venice for 10 days from the 6th of June. There was also a conference on the regimental history, and I was given the job of helping Ian Miller, who was one of our captains and an Australian Rhodes scholar, to compile the history, and the results are in a little printed thing of which I've got a copy.
Who was behind the idea of getting this sorted out?
I would guess that it must have been fairly general in the army. I would hope so.
Who actually summoned the conference where you were given this role? Was it
That would be the CO. Yeah.
The CO.
Yeah. Yes.
Did he give any particular instructions about how it was to be done or what the purpose of it was?
I can't remember, but a speculation would be that it would be part of a compilation of the history being done by the whole division. By the division on the one hand, including the infantry, but of course by the HQRA on the other, since we were really gunners only. I mean, we were partly divisional soldiers and partly gunners. We belonged to two lots. Most people's thoughts are constantly about the Far East. On the other hand, Tito is still being awkward here. We were getting a lot of material from the Army Bureau of Current Affairs at this time, APCA.
Yes.
And apart from gun and vehicle inspections, routine sort of physical work, we had APCA talks. I note that a sergeant gave us an APCA talk at this time.
Was this a sergeant from outside or one?
I'm trying to think. I think it must have been Sergeant Prowse. The name doesn't ring a bell, so I think it must have been from outside, possibly even from Education Corps. You know, there was a sort of Education Corps somewhere in the background.
Were the soldiers interested in these ABCA lectures?
Oh, indeed, yes. People, you know, were beginning to wake up to the fact that the war was over, and apart from an odd bit of Tito, and that they're all heading back to known or unknown prospects. It took a long time, in a sense, for this reorientation to take place, because when you've been concentrating on, you know, keeping alive and winning a war and all that, you don't really think, it's impossible to think in terms of normality. Mm. And the period of readjustment is quite difficult to think of actually becoming a student again, in my case, or whatever. And, farewell party for Eilat, off to the 8th Indian Division. Next day, Sunday the 2nd of June, whole day on a trip to Trieste. Find the brewery and have lunch in the transit mess. Heaps of people around bathing. It's a lovely place, Trieste. Joined a yacht club there, went on the sea for the first time in a sailing dinghy at Trieste. Busy Sunday, 3rd June, reading regimental history accounts contributed by various people and rewriting some of them. So I was obviously acting as a sort of editor or assistant editor for the regimental history. I'd quite forgotten this, but took a jeep in the afternoon with Jack Davidson down to the sea. We must have been relatively near the sea, and found it hugely enjoyable compared with any sea back home where it's cold and grey. This was pellucid blue water and it was warm. For the first time I really enjoyed swimming. Not that I was any good at it, but I enjoyed it. Write various letters home, still wondering about Far East prospects. Monday the 4th June, hold conference in education room to coordinate the gunner end of the regimental history, filling gaps. All of my diaries and intelligence records were coming in very useful, as it turned out.
How did you fill in the gaps? Did this mean you were actually interviewing gunners?
I don't think so. I think it was a matter of looking through the firing records to fill in the gaps between the major battles, which would have been well recorded, and the intervening periods, which would not have been. Mind you, I think it was a large waste of time, because in the eventual regimental history, which is here, it was very much a précis of the whole enterprise. 5th of June, hand over education to the battery commander, because I'm going on a course. Hear that the Far East service limit has been now raised to 2 years for exemption, and I've only been abroad for 1 year, 10 months. Dismal. Discuss with Jack the possibilities of getting into the higher civil service. Wednesday 6, 7 a.m, off to Venice. Lido, magnificent. Sorry.
What was it that was attracting you to the civil service?
Oh, I'd always wanted to go into the civil service. As a boy without means and with ambition, there were only two courses, really, in those days, without money. I mean, if you had money, you could buy articles to solicitors and this kind of thing. If you hadn't money, there were two careers open to the talents. One was teaching. My father was a teacher. He didn't want me to go in for teaching because the career prospects were not good enough. He knew something through contacts about the civil service. I had focused on the civil service at the age of 15 because in theory it was the career totally open for the talent. You could go to the top if you were lucky without any particular social obstacles, and it meant doing interesting things. It meant going to London, probably, which is interesting. All kinds of reasons. It was the career if you could get into it, but it did mean, I mean, if one can digress for a moment, there were three levels of entry: clerical, which was done following school certificate. There was executive, which was a very limited exam, 150 places a year for the whole country, which followed A-level. And there was the top administrative class exam, which was for graduates, said to be the most difficult exam in the country, which took in about 20 or 30 people a year from all the universities, but nobody ever outside Oxford, Cambridge, sometimes an occasional London one and an occasional Scot got in. So nobody had ever, to my knowledge, got into the higher civil service from any provincial university, including Nottingham. So the question arose whether the academic social obstacles of not having gone through public school in Oxbridge could be overcome under the proposed new method of recruitment to fill post-war numerous vacancies in the higher civil service, which was to be done through the WASB style of thing, which would be general intelligence, general knowledge, essay writing, arithmetic, all mathematics, all sorts of things which were not susceptible of either social or Oxbridge academic influence. In other words, tests of general ability. And I was willing to chance my arm, as others were, on this, even though we would have stood little chance, for the reasons I've given, of getting through the academic peacetime exam, which was totally Oxbridge orientated. That's a digression, but it explains why the civil service, which I had always wanted and expected to go in at a lower level, now became just a remote possibility of going at a higher level.
And you've been mentioning you were doing education in the Battery. What did that entail doing? What were your functions?
Well, I mean, very little had happened so far. I was simply organising the any talks on ABCA, and that was about it. I mean, it hadn't happened except in theory.
So you were planning. You were planning.
It was planning how to set up an education resource for people before demobilisation. But so far we'd been thwarted because of Tito, and it hadn't happened. And well, we're now in the sticks without education being really no base to do it.
What's the intention behind the education, to prepare men for return to civilian life, or did it have other aims?
Well, it's partly that would be number one aim, as will be apparent a little bit later. But the secondary aim, of course, was to broaden people's horizon, to give them an interest. And for the very best of motives, Army Bureau of Current Affairs, etc., etc., a new world, a new government, a post-war, a world to be rebuilt, all of these things were quite actively thought about. I mean, nobody was trying to seriously to teach people English literature or French or whatever, but to broaden horizons at the end of this rather narrow thing of war must have seemed very sensibly to people high up to be important. And furthermore, of course, it would occupy time, which otherwise would be spent on vehicle inspection and the like.
Or
gambling, or women womanizing, or it was keeping
drinking.
People. Yep, that's right. That's right. Anyway, I had this course in Venice, and it was fascinating.
Who taught you on that course?
Good question. I wish I could remember. Let's see what it says. I had the town major's bed and met an old friend from Octu, who was somewhat surprisingly, it's rather like Evelyn Waugh. He was living with a countess on the Grand Canal.
That's really fraternising with the enemy.
Yes, he'd really got it made, and he had a wife and children at home. Much tea in the officer's cafe, and see an enormous officer's rest hotel, but we're not allowed to use it because we're on duty, we're not on holiday. Course begins on the Lido, which is, I don't know whether you know Venice, but the Lido lies across the lagoon. It is a considerable self-contained island. The sergeant instructors are good, but the subjects are too specialised for their general knowledge range. Now, I'm not quite clear what that means. It's a current affairs course. Yes, I see. This was preparing me to be able to prepare the troops back at the regiment presumably for the post-war world. But we concentrate on public systems. Presumably this was organisation of government, local government, etc., back in this country. The next day I heard the Yugoslav business now resolved. Their forces are going to withdraw, leaving 2,000 only. And I hope the regiment has moved somewhere else in my absence from this miserable no man's land in the hills. This course in Venice went on, morning periods on course, afternoons off, walks on the seafront, playing games, etc., etc., generally socialising. Take out the daughter of the house I'm billeted in.
You're saying that you were taken to St. Mark's by the daughter of the house where you were staying.
That's right. I was billeted on a house with a sort of middle-class family, a professional man and his wife and daughter, and the daughter was a girl of about 1920 whose fiancé was a prisoner of war with the Germans. And in the most harmless possible way, we went around together for a couple of evenings, and she, Sunday the 10th of June, she took me to St. Mark's. Which was lovely, now that the sandbags have been removed, which I had seen a month before as protective stuff in case there was fighting there.
Had there been any fighting in Venice?
No. The 2nd New Zealand Division, as I recall, walked in and emptied the central bank. And that was there was no fighting. There was just a lot of release. And a lot of money spent. The shops were doing very good business in Venice. You asked what happened to the money that the troops who sold German horses to Italian farmers, what they did with it. Well, I can tell you that my batman got as high as, I think, £1,200 in his takings from selling German army horses. And he went into Venice and blew the whole lot on one superlative lace tablecloth, which must have measured about 12 feet by 6, and which, if it's still extant, would be worth a fortune, I should think. And this sort of thing was happening. It was the first place in which saved money could be released in any worthwhile way. And, of course, the Venetians must have made a bomb. Shall I? So, it was an exciting place. I don't know whether you know Venice, but it is quite an exciting place. It was in those days. Far now, it is just a scrummage. Far too many people there, but...
Was there any organised tourism for the soldiers?
I don't remember. I suppose there must have been, but it wasn't necessary, really. All you needed was a map, street map.
What method of instruction did they employ on this course for you?
Interesting you should say that, because I was trying to remember when I came across the diary entry of Monday the 11th of June, and I note that we had a day of heated discussions on industry and nationalisation, etc. So obviously the sort of political nature of the post-war settlement, change of government and all that, was very evident, and I've put there's a noticeable left tendency among all the instructors who are quite good teachers. And this was in keeping with the spirit of the times. And we had, I mean, when I spoke of change of government, of course the government had not changed until July, but this was the period leading up to the general election. I can't remember whether the general election had in fact been called at this time. Possibly we were on the verge of the dissolution of Parliament. Yes, early to mid-June we would be. But there was a tremendous head of steam for change, the like of which I haven't witnessed until the first part of this year, 1997, when you got the same sense that people wanted this lot out. Whoever this lot happened to be, they wanted them out.
Because they had no particularly detailed ideas about what the other lot might be like.
Well, that's right. But in that case, of course, they did have fairly specific ideas because of the... I mean, one had had Labour ministers serving throughout the war as ministers. They were not an unknown quantity. You had Ernest Bevin in situ, Attlee as Deputy Prime Minister, and quite a lot of others doing service as ministers under Churchill. So they were not, people were not able to say, as they were saying a year ago, 1996-97, my friends who instinctive conservatives saying to me, but how can we trust Labour, not because of policies, but because none of them have ever served as ministers too long ago. Well, there was, I thought, a degree of unreason in that, but it couldn't even be said in 1945, because they had been ministers.
Did people know of the Beveridge Report?
Oh, certainly. I myself lectured to the troops on the Beveridge Report. Big gatherings, too. I mean, it was voluntary attendance, but one had as many as 300 or 400... In the lecture halls. Yes, you see, 11th, we debated all day industry and nationalisation. The 12th, Tuesday, all day on trade unions and social security. And I saw details of the post-war renewed civil service exams in the newspaper, the army newspaper. These were the first exams for the civil service to be held since 1939. This was going to be 7 years later in 1946. Sunbathing in the afternoon, chamber music concert in Venice, going by boat from the Lido. There's a constant stream of bus service style vaporettos, motorboats from the Lido to Venice. Dinner at the Europa with unrationed beer, the first time anything had been unrationed. Crowded boat back for another late night. Wednesday the 13th, the new education system. Now this was the 1944 Education Act, which of course was by now on the statute book, the Butler Act, dividing schools into secondary modern, secondary technical and grammar, which proved to be fallible in ways we know, particularly the fact that nobody ever really developed any technical schools, so that the middle plank of this platform never appeared. You only had the grammar and the
secondary modern,
and out of the disarray to an extent caused by this came the comprehensive schools. But this array, needless to say, partly largely due to the, this is not on the subject of the war, the unreliable nature of the selection process. If you have, as you do indeed have, or did, 15 to 20 to 25% inaccuracy rate among your selection for grammar schools, then it meant that neither they nor the secondary moderns were doing the job they should be doing. Here we are. They must have called the general election, because I said that we are furious because no papers are available to buy, and vital general election speeches are appearing daily in the papers if you can get them. So there was a semi-fevered attitude. We were all focusing on things back home.
Did this apply to the regular officers as well as to you, who were war?
Well, I'm sure they deplored it just as much as we welcomed it. I mean, everything's all right as far as they were concerned. I didn't meet... I mean, this is obviously unfair generalisation, but regular officers were not much interested in change. Thursday the 14th, we've gone through nationalisation, trade union, social security, education. Thursday the 14th, health service discussed. Of course, the new health service white paper was out for the establishment of the NHS. Questions of birth rate and birth control. And at this stage, I was sort of midway between having been felt I was owing some allegiance to the Catholic Church and being a heretic, and I was vexed, didn't know which way to turn, on anti-Catholic remarks by some members of the group about birth rate and birth control. Friday the 15th, usual heated discussions, this time about monopolies, etc., but nobody really sufficiently au fait with the subject.
Do you know what size of group you were in for these discussions?
No, I was trying to think. I mean, my guess would be that it was, and I may be wrong, but I don't think far out would be 25. And they would be an assortment of officers and probably senior NCOs. That would be the usual setup, particularly since the thing seems to have been conducted by Education Corps NCO sergeants.
Were they educated men?
Yes, I would think that they were mostly either senior schoolmasters or dons. You know, one found quite a lot of university dons in the army who, the fact that they were sergeants were neither here nor there, because frequently the most donish people were the least suited to be commissioned anyway. Friday the 15th, usual heated discussions, this time about monopolies. Yes, we've said that. And Saturday the 16th was the last day, agricultural talks. This is about, goodness knows, chicken farms. I can't think what that had to do with the future of civilization. But
well, considering that during the course of the war, country had come close to running out of food on
it. Yes, it could have been battery farming.
Might
yes,
have been about
more intensive.
The reorganisation of agricultural activities.
Yes, it could have been.
Well,
plainly, you're quite right. I mean, we were absorbed with the need in future to be self-sufficient.
Yes.
Because of the difficulties of getting, well, the rationing had been going on for 6 years. We were not self-sufficient, and in a measurable period after the war, we did become virtually self-sufficient. Not for luxury goods, not for pineapples, but certainly for all basics, as I found out in subsequent careers. I remember sitting on the beach in the moonlight with this girl, Lena, who was quite an interesting lass, and we are sitting there and we are approached by youths bent on trouble, sort of embryonic vandals, and they asked me who I was, and I said I'm an English officer, why? And told them in what Italian I had, they better shove off, and to my good fortune they did. They might not have done.
How many were there?
Two. Sunday the 17th, up 6:30, tired, off on a landing craft tank with luggage, using obviously military and naval transport for the troops, so that we didn't have to use the civilian.